Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and thank you so much for being with us on this Memorial Day. It's been a fun weekend for me. I spent, Renee and Emily and I spent the weekend. They're still at Long Lake, on Long Lake, just north of Rice Lake, at George and Ed Detmer's home. They've got a great couple of place cabins, homes on the lake, and we really enjoyed our time there. And arrived on Friday, and I tell you what, I was looking out the window at their home, and there was a great big pileated woodpecker right next to the window at one of the feeders. So it's great. It was great to see my first pileated of the year on Long Lake, and I really enjoyed it. And it leads me into our conversation today, because we're talking birds through the program, throughout the program. We often do this pretty much every holiday, as a matter of fact. And Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at the Horican Marsh International Education Center, one of our guests today. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am, Larry. Thanks so much for taking your time out of the holiday, and thanks for having us on air.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us, and as well, Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, are you with us?
I'm here too, Larry.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you guys so much for taking your Memorial Day to be with us today. And I tell you what, it was great to see that pileated woodpecker.
They're actually not that uncommon. It is a relatively secretive bird. They need some large forest tracts. And normally we think of that northern half of Wisconsin where the birds tend to be pretty prevalent, but the northern Kettle Moraine and some of these larger forest stands, the Baraboo Hills, southwestern Wisconsin, lower Wisconsin River, for example, excellent places, always a good sighting. You can't guarantee them, but they're great.
They're great. I want to give the number for people to join in. Again, if you'd like to join us, maybe you have a question about the bird migrations or just birds in general, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Bill or Noel, are one of the other of you at our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show?
I do not get on Facebook here at I'm in a company headquarters building, and they don't allow us to get on Facebook, Larry.
Well, Bill, what about you?
I've kind of the same restriction here, but we did have your program producer, Judith, forward a number of emails and photos.
Great.
And appreciate people sharing those. Great.
Oh, wonderful. So if we've got some identification issues, we might be able to handle them via email, if nothing else.
You bet.
Yes, you can.
All right, wonderful. And, Bill, I understand from Judith that you were going to go out this morning and try and see how many birds, types of birds?
Well, I thought this would be a nice time to get out and see 100 different kinds of birds before we went on the air.
Did you
start out the morning?
How did you do?
I'm at 101 right now, and there's actually a couple of common things I missed. I didn't stick around my hummingbird feeder for a few extra minutes. He didn't show up when I was there. I have phoebes nesting right under the house. I walked by the nest. She was off of it. I'll pick those up later on. And then, you know, like bird watching, you miss some of the easy ones and things that you expect, but I had some other great birds. Black-billed cuckoos calling, hooded warbler, Bonaparte's gulls, a little late for those yet, but I had a flock here at Horican Marsh, red-headed woodpecker as well on a marsh. Good stuff.
Oh, excellent stuff. Noel, how about you?
Well, I've been out too, and we had a couple of birdathons last weekend. One here at River Ridge Nature Center for the Bird Club, and we found 102 species before noontime when it started to rain on about 300 acres. And you know, I didn't range all over the territory like Bill did this morning. And then out in the Honey Creek area in Sauk County on Sunday, small acreage that again Wisconsin Society for Ornithology had, and we found 94 species there. Also in the morning.
Boy.
So, if you go out and range around and you can identify stuff with both sight and sound, you can come up with 100 species this time of year.
What about the migration? Did the late sort of spring slow anything down, Bill? And did you notice?
It slowed everything down.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's interesting is most springs, we get this sort of stop and start. So you get a warm front, you get a warm day, you get good south winds, which is what birds need to really move in migration. And then the wind shifts, you get cool, rainy days, and shuts things down. And as birds are migrating at different times throughout that whole period, some are a little ahead of schedule, some get slowed down, and you wait for things to pick up again. This spring, it was just everything was behind schedule. The entire 2 months of April, May, even into March, we hardly had any exceptionally warm days, a lot of north wind. Even our Canada geese laid their eggs at least a week later than normal. Normally, the last few days of April, the first week of May, they're all hatching out. It wasn't until we were well beyond the first week of May that I started seeing goslings. Everything was behind schedule. The ice went off the lakes late, so the ducks and other water birds showed up a little later in the spring season. However, there was one thing that was really a plus. Because it was so cool, the leaves were very late to come out. When the songbirds arrived, especially the big wave of warblers, which the bird watchers really look for, more than 35 species of these little tropical songbirds come through Wisconsin in month of May primarily. Well, a lot of times if we have an early spring, the leaves are out, they're hidden before they even get here, yeah. And they're hard to see. This year, the leaves were so slow to emerge, these birds were really easy to see. And on top of that, some of the species of warblers tend to stick way in the treetops where they're hard to observe. The leaves weren't even open. There was no food up there. So they're in the middle and lower part of the trees, and in spite of the really kind of lousy spring we had, it was some of the most extraordinary warbler and songbird watching in those first couple of weeks of May that I've seen in probably 10, 15 years.
Oh, that's very cool.
So there was a plus. It was great that way.
And Noel, you had a similar experience, I would bet.
Yeah, that's correct. And things were all kind of mixed up. Very often you kind of get an orderly progression of species from early spring to mid-spring to late spring, and because things were kind of held up because of the cold weather and the fronts south of us, a lot of the neotropical migrants, of course, leave Central and South America at the same time every year, and they got to the United States, and they kind of lingered for a while the others got in here late also. But then we had spring warblers or the early spring warblers kind of mixed in right with the later spring birds. So we had kinglets and yellow-rumped warblers and palm warblers mixed in
wow.
with some of the ones that don't usually get here until late May.
Wow. Well, Peggy in Tigerton, Wisconsin, has a comment or question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
What a great show.
Thank you.
I do have a question about wrens. I heard them a couple of weeks ago on a day or two, and then I haven't seen or heard them since. And we've always had wrens, and we cleaned out the houses, and it should be wren time. But where are they?
Well, they definitely get here in early May.
Uh-huh.
And, if you have a suitable hole cavity in a nest box or whatever, they usually do stay, as you say. I really can't explain why they didn't this year, but keep it out there, and there's still a good chance that as we get into June that our wren will come by and maybe even a second nesting attempt, and they'll nest into July, so I wouldn't give up hope yet.
Okay. We also have noticed a lot of other birds. For the first time, we have orioles that are staying and many indigo buntings that usually a pair or two, maybe. So it's an unusual year in that respect, too.
A lot of people saw a lot of action this year at their feeders because it was so kind of tough foraging conditions for insects and so forth. So the blackbirds really hung around feeders, but people in general have really noticed a lot of bird activity around their hummingbird feeders and their oranges and grape jelly and seed feeders as well.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks, Peggy, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mickey in Richland County, let's go to you now. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. Hi there. Listen, we have a place in far end of Richland County, and we have a pair of pileated woodpeckers that we see occasionally all year round. But yesterday I saw a little yellow bird, and clearly not a finch. Rounder than a finch, bright yellow, maybe a shade lighter than a finch, but it had a collar of green and very beautiful gray, like a catbird gray. And I looked in all my bird books. I thought maybe it was a warbler, but I couldn't see it in any of the bird books.
Hmm. Well, Bill, do you have an idea?
You mentioned a darker collar. First thing that came to my mind was meadow lark, but it sounds like you're talking about something quite smaller than that.
Yes.
Possibly, I don't know, a couple of images coming to my mind here from your description. Perula or Perula warbler, it's kind of a treetop bird, migrant going north. He's got this wash of yellowish in the throat, kind of a blue in the back, green in the middle of the back.
No, this was very yellow bird, you know, one shade lower than a finch, but very yellow. And then this collar of green and gray, and I can't remember which was on the top and which was on the bottom of it. But
another one that comes to my mind is maybe Canada warbler. It tends to be one of the warblers that's rather than in the trees, low in the bushes. They're heading up into the spruce bogs. It has this beautiful necklace, as they refer to it, just a string of black around the upper breast with streaks running down from there. Brilliant yellow breast and a very slate gray back. Does that sound like it?
Possibly. No, what do you think?
Was the whole head gray or just a, you said a collar, was a head yellow and then the collar and then more yellow?
No, the whole bird was yellow. And
even the back.
But the collar, I think the back too. I'm not sure I saw the back. But the collar was green and gray, and it was round-shaped. That's the other thing. That's why I first started looking in the book under warbler. But then I couldn't find anything, and I looked, for everything that was yellow. Had any yellow.
Well, green is not a common color that, many birds that we have. Of course, hummingbirds are, and even though it's not green pigment, that's just the fluorescence off the feathers. But green is not a common color in most of our birds that come through Wisconsin. So I think Bill and I are both stumped.
If you get if you can ever get a picture of it, Mickey.
Yeah, well, it was just for very fleeting. I mean, I just saw it for a moment, enough to know, oh, wow.
Something different, yeah. Well, if it stops by again and you get a picture, please send it to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll post it. And Bill and Noel can take a look at it, and others will probably chime in. There may be some other people who have some ideas about it too, and they can phone in. Thanks for calling. It's still a mystery, but maybe we can get it solved before the show's over. Right? Thank you, Mickey. And we have more callers online. Just to remind you, though, Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the Department of Natural Resources, Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds today with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, Larry Mueller here, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, and she's been working hard today. She was on since 6 o'clock this morning, so she's been working hard, but she's still got that nice big smile. She looks pretty cheerful. Let's go to Shirley in Prentice. Shirley, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I've read an article in the Marshfield paper about the indigo bunting. It says that their favorite food is millet. Now, I don't think I know what millet looks like. I don't think many people grow it, and a millet seed is what they said.
You're wondering where to get that or where what it looks like. Okay.
It's a beautiful bird.
Yeah.
I also wondered, they said that they eat insects too. So I also wondered if you put Roundup on quack grass, will that injure birds?
Some good questions there. First of all, millet is a small kind of BB size, little white seed. There's also red millet. And if you buy your common bird seed mixes, it's commonly in there. You'll see the millet, cracked corn, sunflower seed is a very common general bird mix. Now, the indigo bunting, as Noel mentioned earlier, has been very visible at feeders, and we usually see them for the first week or two when they first arrive or are passing through. Birds are hungry. There's not a lot of food yet available. But as we get into June and we have the big insect hatches, natural foods available, those birds tend to take advantage then of the invertebrates out there, the insect food, and they don't visit the feeders all that often. At least that's my finding. So you'll see them early on. So the smaller seeds that they can handle, not the big sunflower seeds, since it is a relatively small bird.
What about the herbicide?
Herbicides. Herbicides, you know, we've always got to be careful with them because there is that chance for environmental contamination, either directly or indirectly. The harshest of the chemicals, we've banned those, such as DDT, but you always want to be careful when you're applying that. Whether there is, say, a direct effect of spraying quack grass that could lead to bird mortality, I don't know if there's real conclusive evidence for that. We do know when there was a heavy testing done in New York a number of years ago when West Nile virus first hit, they took a very intensive look at songbird deaths to see how prevalent West Nile virus was as a cause. And just by doing the analysis, they found that toxic poisoning from a number of different sources seemed to be account for most of these songbird deaths. So we do know that, you know, we can have an impact. So always be careful when you're applying anything like that. I don't know if we can say for sure any one chemical over another, but or the timing of the year, for example, mm-hmm. when it may be more harmful to wildlife. But, yeah, definitely always follow the label and be very judicious in your use.
Yeah, a couple of comments on that. Roundup does break down to just common chemicals very, very quickly, and I think it's generally viewed as pretty bird safe. So I wouldn't hesitate to use it on crack grass or any other invasive species that you have to deal with. It's used quite commonly, but as Bill says, make sure you follow all the rules and regulations that's posted on the container. I only feed four different kinds of seed. I feed black oil sunflower, so-called Niger seed or thistle seed in a special thistle feeder. I also offer corn that's still on the cob. Then I put white millet on the ground for sparrows. And this year, again, with the cool spring, the white crowned sparrows and white-throated sparrows, along with juncos and tree sparrows and song sparrows and field sparrows, they all really came in and really chowed down on white millet. I find it to be an excellent feed for the ones that really prefer grain. As Bill says, when indigo bunnings first get here, they'll definitely go to seed feeders.
There you go. Thank you very much, Shirley, for calling. We got an email from Rachel in Janesville, just returned from a trip to Ferryville along the upper Mississippi River. Didn't see any red-shouldered hawks or red tails, etc. The only birds of prey were the eagles. My question, I assume that during the decades of eagle decline across Wisconsin, these smaller opportunistic hawks moved into the eagles' previous territories along permanent waterways. Could you elaborate on the relationship between eagles and other birds of prey? As eagle populations soar, so to speak, will Wisconsin hawks leave waterway territory in favor of the unchallenged terrain of the prairie? What do you think, Bill?
Probably not. These birds evolved together, and they've also specialized in their diets. Eagles are primarily fish eaters during the open water period. They will feed on carrion during the wintertime. So here you've got a fisherman, so to speak, and your red-tailed hawk and red-shouldered hawks are really taking rodents, small mammal prey. The red-shouldered hawk will even take snakes. They're more of an upland feeder. So I wouldn't say that the comeback of the eagle is crowding out the red-shouldered or red-tailed hawk. Red-shouldered hawk remains on the threatened species list in Wisconsin. It is a lowland forest specialist. Seems like the population is doing quite well around the state, and we may even want to reevaluate that, whether the population is not widespread enough to be taken off that list. The only thing we have seen is the comeback of the eagle happens so rapidly, and the birds tend to move out from their natal home. So in other words, where a young one is born, they're not coming right back to that same lake or territory. They pioneer quite easily when they mature, and they seem to have actually held back the osprey. The osprey, also called the fish hawk, there is competition between eagle and osprey, and it seems that the slow recovery of osprey may have been hindered by the rapid recovery of the eagle. But even now, the osprey is off the threatened and endangered list in Wisconsin and fully recovered. Probably one reason why you're not seeing the hawks so easily right now, And this morning when I was out birding, I did hear one red-shouldered hawk, and I had a little hard time trying to find red-tail. Finally, a few of them were out there feeding. These birds are nesting, and they become much more reclusive, and that's why this morning I had a hard time finding birds I could normally count on. They don't call as vigorously. They're not as active now that they're nesting and tending young or eggs. And also, today is one of our first warm days in, well, quite some time, I guess. And by about 9 o'clock, with the heat of the day starting, birds are becoming also a little more reclusive. They're slowing down. So they can be hard to find.
There you go. Thank you so much for that email. And we had an email from Ann in Campbellsport. Would you have a good suggestion for a bird book that focuses on Wisconsin birds migration? I thought it would be a good gift for my son who has recently discovered birds. Well, I think we've got one or two that we could recommend, Noel.
Yeah, there's several out there on the market. It seems like every year we get a new bird book on the market, and each one kind of have their own favorites that you prefer. And for a beginner, I think I would still stick to Roger Torrey Peterson's Birds of the Eastern U.S. I think it really helps to have that because it points out really what some of the key identification characters you should look at when you're looking at a bird. Others like the National Geographic or some of the others cover the whole United States, but for a beginner, I think it helps not to have to sort through so many species. And for a beginning bird watcher, I still really like the Peterson field guide put out by Houghton Mifflin, and you can obtain it online or at any decent bird or any bookstore, or go into a Wild Birds Unlimited type store that has a whole selection of books. I would stay away for a beginner. For I know you had Richard Crosley on here earlier this year. You know, it's a fantastic book. I really enjoy it, but for a beginner, I think I'd stay away from something like that. That is more for a more advanced birder, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
My hint would also be find one book that just really works well for you, where the pictures are easy to relate to, and look at some of the common birds. Remember, these are, of course, artist illustrations, and see something that depicts the bird well for you, and then stick with that bird book and really get to know it well so that you get an idea of the organization, and when you see something, at least you can guess what family it's in. You can thumb through it quickly and try to find it. Once you've exhausted that book and you've worn it out and you really know it, then buy something else and build on that knowledge, get a little different perspective, and look at more detail.
There you go. And, here's one we need to work on right away. We've got an email from Joe in Portage County. Help, I have a hummingbird trapped in my garage. She got in last night, can't find her way out, even though the garage door has been open since I found her. She instinctively heads up, refuses to drop down far enough to see the way out. Normally, I wrap the emergency handle of my garage door opener with aluminum foil. I didn't get it done this year, so I think maybe the red color may have attracted her in. I moved the feeder into the garage so it has food. How do I get her out?
Just wait.
Yeah.
If the bird got in late in the day, they will oftentimes get ready for roosting. They'll settle down and just simply spend the night there. And hummingbirds during cool evenings will actually go into sort of a semi-hibernation state just to slow down their metabolism. It is not unusual that when birds get trapped in buildings or enclosures, they want to fly up. That's their natural instinct. So it can be tough for them to find the door. They'll get the hint. Open up the big overhead door. Give her a little bit of time and just stay away a little bit so she can just, rather than flee from your presence, try to find an escape route. She can just finally figure out how she got in and get back out again.
Yeah, I saw my first hummingbird this year sitting in the entrance of the garage, and one flew in over my head just for a couple of feet, but then flew right back out. So I didn't have the problem that Joe has, but Bill offers good advice.
Let's go to Joanne in Lac des Flambeaux, who has something relating to hummingbirds as well. Hi, Joanne.
Good morning, Larry. And I have an answer to the person that was just the email you just talked to.
Yeah.
When we get a hummingbird in our garage, we'll set a chair or something outside of the garage and put either a red jacket or a red shirt, and in little or no time, they're out of there.
Oh.
Right for the open door.
There you go. That's a good lure.
Yeah. And my question was, the first hummingbird we seen here was May 10th. And now this morning, my husband is saying, oh, we got just a real little one sitting on one of the feeders. Would they have hatched already?
No, not at all. They're just in the process of probably building a nest, or some may, here in the southern part of the state anyway, may be sitting on eggs now, but no, there's no way that you would have a young one yet. You know, there is a little bit of a variation from individual to individual. The females tend to be just slightly smaller, so maybe this is just an extra small one, but no young yet.
How long does it take them to for the babies to come?
I don't think you'll see young hummingbirds until July.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, then it definitely is no baby.
No.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Joanne, for calling. And again, on hummingbirds, we got on the Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, Patrick sent a picture of a hummingbird. He thought it was a, let's see.
Black chin.
Yeah, and it looks more like a ruby-throated to me, but what do you guys think?
Well, the chin of the male, that throat, that's an iridescent color. So if you look at it in the lighting, it'll change from a real dark blackish color to all of a sudden when it catches the light, it'll just glow in that ruby color. So that's reflected light. And the birds will use that in attracting the mate. In fact, the other day I had two of them. What caught my attention was I could hear the male buzzing back and forth. He does his little U-shaped aerial courtship display. And he tries to find a position so that he's facing the female with the sunlight glistening off his throat, and he does these little flight, swoop down, back up again, and back and forth, and he's flashing that, what we call the gorget, that brilliant red throat at the female.
Yeah.
All he's got to do is turn a couple of degrees, and that brilliant ruby red goes to black.
There you go.
I think that's what he was really seeing. Wait for him to turn right for you.
And as long as we're on the Facebook page here, Valerie sent us a photo. You guys didn't see this one yet, but it's an oriole flew into the patio door, then hung upside down on the ledge for a few minutes before flying away. And she's got a picture of it hanging upside down on the ledge of the patio door.
Well, there may have been a lack of a perch for the bird to get a hold of. And orioles have very strong feet and are pretty agile in order to weave that nest and also searching around the trees for some of that insect food. Perhaps no other perch was available, and just clasped whatever was there. And upside down may work for it for a while.
Yeah,
and that's what makes bird watching so interesting, is watching its behavior. I have a sweet-toothed chickadee this year. I have a ant trap up on top of my hummingbird feeder, which has water in it, and we put water in, and chickadees will come down and feed that or take the water along with other species. But we actually have one coming and taking the sugar water this year right from the perches that the orioles and hummingbirds use. So
very cool.
Not sure what's up with that chickadee.
It's an odd diet.
Very cool. And let's see, we have, Raymond also on the Facebook page suggested for as a book, The Birds of Wisconsin by Stan DeKella. He started his children on the book, and they loved it.
Yeah, Stan's book is good, and he's kind of got a formula where he I think he started in Minnesota and put out Birds of Minnesota, and then you just make a few changes, and it's Birds of Wisconsin. Now he's got Birds of Illinois, Birds of Indiana, and he's been very successful in trying to tailor make his book for just the species that occur in each of the states.
On to Chester in Athens. Hi, Chester. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just have a few observations about some wrens. Matter of fact, I live just north of Wren Road, but each year I get a wren family that comes into my electrical box, even though I have wren boxes out, which they use. But this one family comes into, and you wouldn't believe how small this outlet opening is, and yet each year they seem to raise a family there. And I was wondering, is there any danger of them getting electrocuted?
Hmm.
Well, there's always that chance, I suppose. It depends on how the box is configured. Well, we had something just 2 weeks ago. Half the city of Mayville was out for a while when a squirrel got into a transformer. So, I suppose if there's some exposure there, perhaps. But, it sounds like the bird nested there last year, this year, and between it and its young didn't seem to have any problem. So, apparently they're proving it wrong that they know something about electricity or they're just lucky.
There you go.
You could just put some electrical tape over the hole, and if you, since you have boxes out, I'm sure they'd find your alternative sites wonderful.
That's a good idea. Thanks, Chester, for calling. Appreciate it. Ron in Newburgh, we're going to you now. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning, fellows. Interesting, Ridges Sanctuary had a program over the weekend, and a couple of us were canoeing on one of the Door County lakes. And going along the reeds, all of a sudden we noticed a mound, and something looked a little funny about it. And looking closer, here was a sandhill crane, assumed the female, laying flat out for as long as it is, the body over the eggs, and the feet to one end and the head to the other. And as we paddled closer, of course, it jumped up and off it went. But very quickly, it came back to the nest. But that's the first time that I've ever seen, you know, a nesting bird lay like that. It was quite something. And the other thing, out at Tough Point, the Caspian terns were dive-bombing whatever little kind of fish is in there. And to see them come plummeting down into the water, they really make a smack. You can hear it pretty well. And so it was neat. Two good things to see in one weekend.
Oh, yeah. Comment, Noel?
Yeah, it's really amazing how species that nest like that out in the open on ground nests, whether it's a Canada goose or whether it's a sandhill crane, how they can flatten themselves out and blend into the nest so well. And, of course, obviously that has stood them well through the generations. And as we have cranes increasing and using wetlands and areas that they've typically we've never seen them in before, they're always going to be exploring for an area that they suit in. We did have one disturbing report this week, Larry, from out in your neck of the woods of a couple of boys stopping alongside the road and chasing down a young crane called a colt and actually captured them. But fortunately, some citizens in the area yelled at them, and they turned it loose and ran off and got back in their car and took off. But it's always distressing when we hear someone like that chasing down wildlife, a young crane, and whatever their ideas are to take that kind of action. So if anyone sees that sort of thing, be a little, at least don't feel afraid to accost those people and tell them that is very illegal action to do.
There you go. And, Ron, thank you very much for calling. And just in terms of nesting, I was fishing Saturday on Long Lake, and we were in this little protected bay, which I can't divulge the exact location because we caught a lot of bluegills. But there was, going along the shore, I noticed a loon, and we kind of gave it a wide berth. But it was laid out almost flat. And I assumed it was on its nest.
Sounds right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. You had to be looking to just the right angle in order to see it. It was pretty cool. The Facebook page brought us another picture. I think you guys got a copy of from Kurt in Duluth, wondering if you could identify a particular bird.
These are the great horned owls.
Great horned owls.
I think it might be a black cap. Chickadee.
Oh, the chickadee.
Yeah,
one.
Yep, saw that one. Go ahead, Noel.
Yeah, it's definitely a black-capped chickadee, and it does have some little difference in the white and the black on the plumage. That really befuddles people. I saw a picture earlier this year of an oriole where the orange was almost just a pale yellow. And, of course, those kind of plumage variations can really throw someone off, but we shouldn't be all surprised when we see it because it's probably more common than what we realize, but yeah, it was just a black-capped chickadee with its tail, I guess, and maybe back with a little bit difference in color and the black and white in it.
Yeah, I noticed the tail feathers seem to be quite whitish.
Right.
Interesting, as Noel said, these plumage variations, I've seen a number of examples this year as well as people have shared photos. And when we're identifying birds, the two most important things that we look at is the size and shape of the bird, and we look at the colors and color patterns. When you get something that does not have the typical colors, it can really throw you. I had just in the last few days somebody with a mostly white chipping sparrow and an all but pure white junco about a month ago. And both of them, they said, I think I know what this is, but you know, this is what we call leucistic. It's not full albino, but a lot of whitish. And you have to, at that point, you have to look at the shape. Look at the shape of the bird. Yeah, ignore the colors.
And you both mentioned great horned owls, and there's another photo Jeff sent in, some small ones. Are those great horned owls pictures?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our earliest nesting bird in Wisconsin, so the young are getting to be good size already by this time of year.
Yeah, we actually had them nesting a year before last down at the Oak Creek Power Plant, actually laid eggs in December, which is an all-time early record. So they start thinking about this really when it's pretty miserable weather around here.
And Gerald sent a couple of pictures of red-bellied woodpecker, beautiful shot, and another of a ruby-throated hummingbird. You guys, I hope you get a chance to go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We're getting some great photos up of some great birds. And anybody else, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You'll see lots of nice photos this morning of birds in various poses.
That's a neat feature to have, Larry, and it certainly makes the job easier for Bill and I if we see a picture versus someone's description.
Sarah in Zion, Illinois, has a question or comment. Hi.
Hi. I hope this isn't the stupidest question you've ever had, but I was out walking the other day, and there was a pretty big pond and with, like, maybe 10 pairs of mallards in there. And there was this one little brown duck. At first I thought it was a female mallard, but it turned out later I thought it was a wood duck. But there were two mallard males that were just headed in for this wood duck, and every time the wood duck would sit down, they'd give it a few seconds, and then they'd chase it, and they'd take off, and they'd just make these huge circles all over the place around the pond. And then they'd let him land, and he'd always go back to right just the same spot. This wood duck, he was the only wood duck in the pond, and he just wanted to be right next to this pair of mallards. And no matter how many times these other mallards tried to chase him away, he just wanted to be right there. And I thought, why doesn't he just go somewhere else? He's like, is that normal?
Well, birds of a feather, right?
Yeah.
The ducks tend to somewhat flock in suitable areas, open water. But what's happening at this time of the year is you're seeing small concentrations of the drakes, the males. And basically, for the most part, their job is done. They've already courted the females, hopefully successfully bred, and females should be on eggs. So the males are getting together to form these little bachelor flocks. What happens is if a raccoon gets into a duck nest or something else happens to that, she now comes back for a second mating, and she gets an overwhelming amount of attention, and she'll just get mobbed by all the drakes in the neighborhood. So perhaps what you had was one of these males just had time to kill. His duties were finished, looking for a little bit of company, and, well, he just wasn't finding somebody of his own kind.
There you go, Sarah. So, Bill in Madison, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was walking my dog at 5 this morning, and I saw something rather interesting. I've seen geese in my life, but if these were geese, they honk like geese, but they had the longest necks I've ever seen on geese. And there were about 70 of them in a perfect V going north. Is it kind of late for geese to go north and honk like geese, or were they some other bird? Really long necks on them and kind of grayish color, flying rather low.
Hmm.
Well, our local nesting geese are appropriately called the giant Canada goose. Of all the different populations, or what are also called subspecies of Canada geese across the United States, the biggest ones are the ones that nest here in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, and of course we've moved those all over the country as they slowly came back. 50 years ago, the bird was nearly extinct. Most of our other populations of Canada geese nest in Canada, in the subarctic and Arctic. So here's a bird that we'll see around. These are the ones that, right now they're out with the young goslings, and within the next month or so they'll be all over the parks and golf courses and causing some conflict with people in those where they want to have some outings. Interesting thing that's happening right now is the non-breeding geese, and they don't breed until they're 2 to 3 years old, and those that may be failed breeders that attempted to nest and didn't pull off a nest, and then also those that have given up their young for adoption. In other words, you'll see a pair of Canada geese with 10, 15, 20, I've seen more than 40 young following one single pair. They only lay 3 to 5 eggs. So they're adopting young from other families. Well, now all these other birds have no parental duties. They don't have any young to care for, or they're not old enough to produce young, or were not successful. They're now getting together in these flocks, And the last week of May and the first few weeks of June, they will now start heading north to find another area away from the breeding ground simply to molt their feathers, to shed the feathers. They may go to northern Wisconsin. They may fly beyond the spruce forest to the subarctic. A number of years ago, Michigan had one of its local birds sighted on Baffin Island north, this is in the eastern Arctic of Canada, north of the Arctic Circle. The bird literally flew well over 1,000 miles just to shed its feathers. So, in other words, the migration of Canada geese, they get here as soon as the snow melts, both the local giant geese and the migrants. The third week of April, our migrants leave, go to Hudson Bay. The local birds are already on the nest. Now, more than a month after the migration, you will see these little flocks getting together, and what should have been this honking and flying and going north of earlier in spring is now what we call a molt migration. They're going to fly literally hundreds, if not more than 1,000 miles, just to shed their feathers. And geese shed all the wing feathers at once. They can't fly for about 3 weeks, so they got to find a place that's suitable.
And safe.
It's a great thing to watch. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Thanks a lot for that question, Bill. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, our guests today. Bill with the DNR. Noel, the past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And please, if you're near a computer, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show, because there are lots of photos up of birds and more coming. Keith from Wanakee, guys, wondered if that unidentified yellow warbler might have been a female Wilson's. Or a female yellow's back may look a little greenish.
Yes, but she mentioned about a collar. Wilson's, the male has this, what we call a little derby. It's a black little spot on top of the head. The female is sort of a yellowish green. No real distinguishing marks otherwise, but no collar is present, which is what she mentioned. She did talk about this sort of greenish color, but I thought it was showing in the collar.
Yeah, you're right. Well, Michael and Joanne in Ferryville say they saw 20 to 30 orioles this year and are now down to 6 that appear to be staying, wondering if they might nest there in Ferryville. And she
said, I think so.
They're on their 9th jar of grape jelly and third dozen of oranges since May 1st.
Yeah, I would say that they're going to be around for breeding. And I have a couple of friends, that husband and wife, that keep track of how many pounds of jelly they feed each year, starting back in 2002. And their all-time high is 75 pounds. And their low was like 11. So, you know, people are always curious about, well, this year everything is here or nothing is here. Or this year they haven't visited me. What? You know, birds do vary from year to year because, you know, 75 pounds of jelly versus 11 pounds of jelly, that's a big range.
That is a very big range.
And I also got an email here from a friend that heard me talking about the sweet-toothed chickadee. He has 3 different species of woodpecker coming to his hummingbird feeder.
Wow.
Or I guess an oriole feeder. Downies and hairies, and this year it's red-bellied woodpecker. So
they're all getting some grape jelly.
All coming into their oriole feeder. So, yeah, woodpeckers can have a sweet tooth, too.
Deborah in Brown Deer has a question. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Oh, this is a great show. And now, you started me on looking for the yellow warbler-type bird, but I didn't hear the whole call. I just tuned in, so I was wondering, looking through my field guide of bird books, it's Donald and Lillian Stokes. Could you turn that down, please? Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
All right. I'm thinking, did the lady, was Pine Warbler one of the guesses already?
Which one did you say?
Well, that yellow bird, everybody's trying to guess what it was. It had a collar, and I thought, I'm looking and I see that the immature female of a pine warbler has...
Oh, pine warbler.
Even though it's gray, it's got a collar, and so I'm thinking the male, which is yellow, but I didn't hear the whole description of the bird, said bird.
Mm.
My call was about a tanager I saw in our backyard, and this is in Brown Deer, and we're very close to the
the Milwaukee River. Like across the street is River Hill, so there's a lot of bird. And then just south of us is Brown Deer Park, so there's a lot of bird activity. And I saw this red bird, and I'm like, oh, is that a cardinal? And then I noticed it had black wings, and then it was in the grass. So I got a picture of it with this little video camera I have. It's like what it's called a small wonder, and I can't really see it when I play it back, and I wanted to download it, but we don't have a computer. So I'm really curious if it's a summer tanager or a scarlet, because the wings were not perfectly black, but they look to have white markings on them. And I'm looking at a summer tanager right now in my book, and I see the female, the immature male, and the male.
Well, your summer tanager is a more uniform, almost kind of a rosy reddish color, where scarlet tanager is just this hot reddish orange with the contrasting black wings. Now, you may have a bird that is just coming into its breeding plumage and may not yet express that full adult breeding colors. But if you're seeing any dark wings contrasting with the brilliant red body, that's scarlet tanager. Summer tanager tends to be a little bit further south. We do get them here in Wisconsin. A good clue is look at the beak. The scarlet tanager, the beak is sort of grayish in color. You've got a very flesh tone, ivory type color bill on the summer tanager.
Okay.
And we've had an awful lot of reports of summer tanagers this year. I think this is a record-breaking year for summer tanagers. I know some people have seen three or four of them in an area. So, but we have no breeding records for summer tanagers. Bill mentioned they're more of a southern species, but with changes with bird populations, we're seeing some of these southern species coming into Wisconsin more and more frequently.
I'm going to try and get it to you guys, and then maybe you can zoom in on it, and I'll be specific where it is in the picture.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Mike in Eastman, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have an ID question for Bill and Noel.
Sure.
I can make the sound. I think it's the same size bird as a, it's the type of grosbeak that eats these little red berries off junipers.
Okay.
Anyway, the chest is the color of a robin's breast. It goes slightly under the wing and not all the way down, and the rest of the belly is cream-colored kind of, maybe white. But the color of the bird is more of a grayish, mottled gray, grayish-black top, and it does have a gross beak. And it makes the same sound as a red-winged blackbird. It goes...
Okay.
It goes... I can call it in as well as the blackbirds, but it makes another sound also, but I can't remember what it was. And I wondered what kind of bird that was.
Well, what do you think, Noel?
I'm not sure, Larry.
Bill, you got an idea?
I was waiting for Noel first. A couple of things rolling around in my head, but just the series of clues he's got there, I haven't got anything that matches up with all of that.
Quite common. I've had a number of them there in late winter into the spring, and right now they kind of disappeared. I suppose they're nesting.
Well, if you get a picture, send it in.
One that's going through my head. Chance it's cedar waxwing, very high thin call. Their calls are right up there. It's a soft, I wouldn't say deep color, quite like what you'd have in the robin, but sort of a tawny color overall. It's got a slight crest on the head.
Also it's got a cedar waxwing.
Also very tame. I can be at the feeder, and it'll sit there and eat and look at me about an arm's length away, and it doesn't get spooked or anything.
You mentioned it going for the juniper or red cedar berries, right?
Yeah, I have a lot of them around here, white cedar too, and I don't know. Well, I've been feeding him seeds. I think he's eating, I'm not sure if it's sunflower. I have a mix I make up and he's up there eating.
Yeah, waxwing's not normally a feeder.
No, they don't come
bird.
To feeders, right?
Yeah.
So it's probably not that. Well, it's probably definitely not that.
Waxwings do not go to feeders?
No.
No. No. Insects and berries is their food.
So,
Get a good photo when next time it's at your feeder. And,
yeah.
Good photo's worth a thousand guesses on our part.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Mike. Thanks. Get that camera out. And let's see. We've got Debbie in Johnson Creek.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have the same good problem that those folks do who are going through all sorts of oranges and grape jelly. I think I'm spending more on that than I am on my own groceries. But that's a good thing. And the question that I wanted to ask, I think you sort of addressed, and that is the fact that I am seeing so many more birds this spring. I live out in the country, and we feed birds all the time. And in the past, I've had maybe one oriole, and he kind of hangs around. But this year, I've seen, you know, four pair, and I've seen orchard orioles, and I've seen gray catbirds, and just many more, and some different ones than I've normally seen. And is there, you know, I know that birds can kind of come and go, but is there something that the weather has, you know, caused this in terms of it's cooler and so for some reason they're staying around or whatever?
Yeah.
I think most definitely they're staying around the feeders more just because, you know, the insects and other invertebrates that they like to feed on when they get back have been in scarce supply. We've just had so much really miserable cool weather that feeders have really been active this spring. So I think the weather is definitely the reason you're seeing more.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the Department of Natural Resources. He works out of Horican Marsh. Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. They'll be our guests right up until 12:30 today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network on this Memorial Day. We're taking a look at birds in Wisconsin with Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at the Horican Marsh International Education Center, works with the DNR. Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, our guest. So great to have them along, and thank you for listening in. We had an email from Eric in Madison who said we watched a pair of house finches build a nest this spring in the Christmas wreath we forgot to take down from our front porch. After leaving town for a few days yesterday, we found the mama gone and five chicks dead, still in the nest. Very sad. What could have happened? We're looking for some closure on this. And Bill, what do you got an idea?
Well, you will occasionally have some nest abandonment or even, say, death for the adult. Hard to say if something may have happened to the female, that she was not able to take care of the young. Accident, hit by a car, flew into a window, house cat. Those are all possibilities. Wreaths, hanging baskets, those types of things around the porch are not uncommon for house finches. Those are pretty common nesting sites. Yeah, unfortunate, but here's a bird that around households, actually population is doing fairly well ever since they were introduced into the eastern United States.
Steph in Elizabeth, Illinois, wonders why small birds sometimes appear to be dive-bombing hawks as they fly. And are the larger birds usually hawks?
Well, they very often are. They view that species as a potential predator, so you know they can get quite aggressive toward them. Of course, certain species do this much more. Red-winged blackbirds and eastern kingbirds come to mind that are quite aggressive to larger birds flying in their region. So, yeah, it's a defense mechanism that they have evolved.
They'll chase crows just as likely.
Yep.
And crows will, of course, also mob owls, and owls will hunt the crows at night.
Right. Mary in Cross Plains, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, and thank you for the program and all your programs. What I'm calling about is how can I get rid of a bird nest humanely? I have either... anyway, they nest under the deck on light fixtures. We have three places, and I'm alone now, and every year that I don't have someone tear it out, the raccoon comes, and you find the baby birds all over the patio. What can I do humanely so I don't feel like Mrs. Scrooge?
Well, first of all, you may want to make it less suitable. Robins and also barn swallows very commonly will nest in protected places like that.
Yeah.
So what you have is, of course, a little shelter from the rain overhead.
Yes.
It's a common place for them to build the nest. And then, of course, when they're right by the front door, they get a little aggressive when you're going in and out, and you end up with the droppings nearby and a little bit of a conflict there.
Okay,
make it unsuitable right from the beginning. If you can put something on top a little bit more pointed, or, you know, so it's not a flat, level area for them to build on, okay, that'd be the first thing. Secondly, keep in mind that once the birds are nesting and you've got eggs and chicks in it, they're now protected by federal law. So what you want to do is discourage them from, to begin with, before they build the nest, or just as they're starting to build the nest before they lay the eggs. If you want to remove some nesting material and try to give them the hint that they're not wanted there, they may find something that's more suitable for both you and them.
Okay, I know what they are. They're least flycatcher or Phoebes.
Phoebes. Yes, Phoebe. And Phoebe's a great bird. I've got them down by my downstairs door. I just give them the right of way. I let them pull off the family. I use the upper door.
It's the raccoons that are kind of the bothersome.
Yeah.
It's a time for some cardboard and duct tape, I think, to essentially try to screen those areas that they prefer to nest on to make them unsuitable to attach a nest. So.
Yep, there you go. Good luck, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Jim in Egg Harbor, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Well, hi. We've been in Egg Harbor about 5 years, and one of the first things we did when we moved up here was to install seed feeders and suet feeders, and we've had regular visits from pileateds and red bellies and hairies and downies. Yesterday, for the first time, we were kind of excited to see a red-headed woodpecker. And we were excited because I had heard that their numbers were on the decline. I remember as a kid back in the late 50s, early 60s, seeing them quite a bit in Brookfield and Elm Grove, but I haven't seen a red-headed woodpecker in,
long time.
Years.
Yeah.
Well, it is a species that definitely has declined. You're right. So it's fortunate that you've been able to see one, and they're still migrating right now. As Bill mentioned, he had one this morning. I've had them this last week, migrating along the western shore of Lake Michigan. And, yeah, they still do nest in Wisconsin, in various places throughout the state, especially in oak woodlands, especially those oak woodlands that are kind of open, scattered, the old type oak savanna that we typically call these areas is probably their preferred habitat in the state. So, yeah, they're still around. So we just hope that they'll find a good place to nest this summer and reproduce.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling, Jim. And Steve in Black River Falls, hello to you.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Two questions for the fellas regarding this year's cold spring and the slower migration. The first question is, will the birds backtrack if they run into some cold weather after they get a little bit to the north, and then with a cold snap, will they fly back south a little ways before moving on? That's the first question. Second question is, with this cold spring, if the birds get to a certain point and it's time for them to build their nest, but they're not at their normal breeding grounds, will they nest where they are because it's time to do that, or will they wait till they get to their usual area?
Well, reverse migration is certainly something that happens. I remember last spring along Lake Michigan up near the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve north of Port, we counted over 5,000 barn swallows all migrating south. And that was just because they had hit conditions that were unfavorable for insects, and they were hoping to retreat to a better location. So birds will definitely move north and south over a short period. We very often will have horned larks in the wintertime coming in late winter, early spring. We get a big snowstorm, they'll retreat back into Illinois. Raptors will do the same sort of thing. So certain of our species definitely can carry on some pretty noticeable reverse migration. As far as early nesting, a lot of these birds will just delay and wait around for a while and then move on north to the places they're heading. I suppose occasionally they may pair up and actually breed at an area south of what they're typically going for, but for the most part, they'll just delay their journey north and wait things out and then continue on.
Hmm.
Okay, thanks, fellas.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Steve in Sun Prairie, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I thought I'd take your show downhill a little bit.
Okay.
My neighbor came over the other day, and he
said that he saw what he said is a blackbird deposit a white substance that I always thought was just plain old bird poop. It looks like a big drop of caulk on his driveway, but he said he vomited it out. Do birds do that?
Bill will enjoy answering this one. This is a fun one.
Oh, good.
Well, you've got a few birds. Well, they will, of course, feed their young that way. So some of them will gather up insects in their bill, will take them along. Birds like pelicans, the young are reaching down into the throat to get that stored food or even sometimes partially digested. One bird that will vomit as far as defense is turkey vulture. And that can be downright disgusting because they live on dead things to begin with,
wow.
And now it's half digested. It works, I'll tell you. That'll keep anybody away from their nest.
Well,
also, great blue herons will do this if you enter a nesting colony. They'll sit up overhead, and they may try to throw up on you. If that doesn't work, they'll try the other end, what I call bombs away. Anything to keep you at bay, and it can work.
I can guarantee you that this wasn't any of those birds. This was like a grackle or a starling or just, you know, the ordinary black bird that flies around Sun Prairie.
Did he drop it while he was flying?
Pardon me?
Did he drop it while he was flying?
I think it was a fecal sac, I think.
That's what I'm thinking. And grackles do a lot of that in the swimming pools. And what's happening is they're nesting, they're nestlings, they're in the nest, they've hatched out, and they, of course, oftentimes have a problem of soiling their own nest. Well, you don't want to do that because you build up both the bacteria and other types of infections and mites and things. So what happens is the droppings of the young are what we call a fecal sac. It is the white droppings, but they're actually kind of a gelatinous little sac. The parents will pick that up and fly away from the nest to both cleanse the nest and keep the smells down. And grackles, which is a fairly early nesting bird, will commonly take those. They love to drop in water for some reason. Swimming pools is a good one for that.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Steve. Appreciate your call. And Pete in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Pete.
Hi, guys. I'm anxious to get home. I've been up north for a week up by the Eau Claire chain, so north of you, Larry.
Oh.
But I'm anxious to see if the wren boxes are occupied and loons are paired off, but not on the nest up there yet. But the question I've got is some recent press from the National Audubon Society about the iPhone app and whether it is actually detrimental with the bird calls. It sounds like it's having some detrimental effects. I'd like to get your guys' opinion on that.
No.
Well, that's one of my kind of pet peeves, I guess, is people playing the song of a bird to attract it, especially during the nesting season. Or especially the rare species that are hard to find, people just get overly anxious to try to find it. And now that we do have these many devices around that are so easy to use, that people are overusing them. I tell people during migration just to play a quick song or something to attract pull a bird in is fine, but especially once a bird starts to settle down to nest. Or to do courtship during the breeding season, I don't think a recording should ever be used for those. So,
okay.
With the proliferation of these devices, I think it's something that birders and people observing wildlife need to be aware of and to really resist the temptation to use them.
The unfortunate thing is it works all too well. And the birds really do respond, and as Noel mentioned, especially the very rare birds, they can get overly harassed, and now as you're playing those, they feel as if there's another competitor who's bigger, louder, more aggressive, and they may actually abandon the territory.
Oh.
Interestingly, down in Arizona, there was a hot spot down there that all the birders know about. It's right by a little town of Portal. And it's one of the only places in the United States, north of Mexico, where you can find the elegant trogon. They've banned tape recorders because a birder comes in, plays it a few times, the bird responds, comes in, and, hey, I got my sighting. Well, next thing you know, another hour later, another birder, next day, there's three more. The birds were actually failing to nest there, and they were being harassed so much, they put an absolute ban on any recordings out there. The other problem is for people like Noel and I, we do most of our identification by ear. I hate that when somebody else is playing something. I cock my ear, go, hey, I got a rare bird. It's like, oh, darn.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Watch that. And don't do that around us.
Okay. Well, we have a thanks again, Pete, for calling. We had a Facebook question from Peter. saw a small bird outside my house early one morning that was displaying an interesting behavior. He was swinging around a small low tree limb, almost like he was on a swing set, except obviously there wasn't a rope or anything to swing on. He would go up one side, swing under the limb, and go to the other side. Very regular, went on for at least 5 minutes. Wondering if this is some sort of mating or other behavior, or if so, does it indicate a specific species? I've never seen anything like it.
Go ahead, Noel.
I'm saying it's silence.
I am silent for a good reason. I have no explanation at all.
Well,
for
as
that.
Noel said earlier, I think that's the fun of bird watching. They do some interesting things, sometimes unusual and crazy things. And there's oftentimes things that birds do that are exceptional, too. And we're always learning something new. So I think that's half the fun of it, is just to get familiar with what's around and also look for these unusual behaviors that just are not typical. I have no explanation for it.
Marcy in Lake Tomahawk says, we always have always had loons build nests in our bay for the last 17 years at least. The last 2 years, either eagles have taken babies or water levels raised and destroyed both egg layings both years. Not seen the loons build a nest in our bay this year. They hang around, but no nest building. Did they decide to change nesting areas, or is it too early for them to be nesting? Well, it's not too early for them to be on the nest, I don't think. What do you comment, Noel?
I think birds do become accustomed to places where they're unsuccessful, and they will move those locations. So predation was certainly something that a bird will notice, that this is not a good location, and try to move it.
And Sue says, we've greatly enjoyed, in Madison, we've greatly enjoyed seeing white pelicans on Madison area, marsh, and lake. They're here for five, they were here for 5 days, 20 at the most, usually 4 to 5. It was a real treat.
They're on Horicon Marsh. They're on the Winnebago chain of lakes. First place they nested in Wisconsin was 1995 in Green Bay. So this eastern part of the state, Horicon, Winnebago to Green Bay, is a good place for pelicans. More recently, they've shown up on the Mississippi River and have nested there the last few years. And we also have birds, and like a lot of these big birds, they don't breed until they're 5, 6 years old. The non-breeders are floating around. We've had reports on Lake Sinisippi, Lake Koshkonong, so down the Rock River, and a number of other big bodies of water in Wisconsin. So this is a bird that is expanding its range to the east, and we now have nesting white pelicans in Wisconsin, which is not a bird you normally think of for our state, but they are around. It's a great sight.
And I don't know if you've gotten it yet, but Judith just sent you a mystery bird to identify. Have you gotten that one yet?
Yeah, and I think we both identified it to the same species. See how good we are when we can see pictures, Larry? It's an American coot.
American coot. It looks like somebody found that one dead. The interesting thing with coot is look at the feet. They don't have web feet. So in other words, the webbing doesn't go from toe to toe, but it's lobed feet. So there's flesh around each individual toe, different way to be able to paddle. It's a unique adaptation for them.
All right. Let's go to Michael in Decorah, Iowa next. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about mourning dove nests.
Okay.
Last year we found one in our yard, and there was a chick by it, and we ended up putting the chick back in the nest, and successfully the parents found it. Mm-hmm. But it was a unique shape. It was very flat, and I was wondering if this was typical, and if so, why? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
They make one of the worst nests out there. It's a couple of sticks. It's a kind of a flat platform. One of the common mortality factors is simply the eggs rolling out of them. You can usually look up through the bottom and see the eggs. They are like the worst house builder out there. So they don't make much of a nest at all. Not unusual. And I should answer this for other people. There's been this myth about if you touch a nest, the eggs or the young, the adults will abandon it. Now, that's true of mammals, such as, say, small rabbits. If you handle them, you leave a scent there, and the parents may abandon them. Birds really don't have a good sense of smell for the most part. Some of our seabirds and turkey vultures do look for food by smell. Most of our birds, it's by sight. So they have got great eyesight and good hearing, but not much of a sense of smell. I think the bigger reason for us to perpetuate this myth of not touching the eggs in the nest, it's this constant attention disturbance in our presence that'll get the birds to abandon the nest. And so we commonly tell young kids, you know, don't touch the nest. Well, it's not touching it, but it's going back every half hour to see how they're doing. Remember, birds are looking for a secure place to shelter that nest with its eggs and young. And if they feel it's been discovered and we've basically give it too much attention, they may abandon and try somewhere else.
All right.
Yeah, one thing that really helps mourning doves, they have a very long nesting season, so they can keep trying over if they have a problem. We've had records of them building nests in March, and they'll go all the way into late July, early August. Mm-hmm. And even though they don't lay very many, you know, eggs, or they can just keep at it.
Bill, there we've had some calls from people wanting you to mention again the Arizona town for bird watching.
Portal.
Yeah.
It's in the Chiricahua Mountains in southeastern Arizona.
There we go. Carl in Blue Mounds, your turn now. Hi, Carl. Carl, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Carl. Let's go to the back to the emails. Chris in Middleton, I live near Pheasant Branch Conservancy in Middleton. My house is wood, as are the other 400 houses in the neighborhood. A woodpecker comes over every morning crossing the 4 to 5 blocks from the woods of the conservancy and pecks on our house. How do I convince it to peck elsewhere, and why is it at our house?
Well, Bill's had woodpecker problems on his house. So.
I gave up. They got so many holes. There's a few reasons. They may actually be searching for food and looking for soft spots in the siding and pecking around, hoping that'll lead to an insect. And that can lead to quite a bit of damage. Or woodpeckers really don't have a vocalization that, as a call, as a song that they make, and so they will drum on a tree of a right resonance. I've had people with woodpeckers, the little downies, pecking on downspouts or other places where you get a good resonance off of it, or he may be searching for food. Either way, get on that bird and be as busy as he is and discourage him from getting a habit going, because wood siding, yeah, they can do quite a bit of damage pecking here and there. And you can try Mylar strips, the shiny plastics. Put that on, but if the wind's not blowing, that doesn't seem to always keep them away. You can try to run out. I can hear them tapping on the house. I just slam on the side of the house right near the window, or I just open a window and quick close it shut, and that'll spook them away. Of course, I'm not there most of the day long, and that's why I got so many holes in the house. They're little peck marks, and I just stain the house every couple of years. I gave up.
Now, Chris mentioned Pheasant Branch. That's one of the wonderful places for migration, to observe migration. And some birders in the Madison area this year were really fortunate to find a black-throated gray warbler that was at Pheasant Branch for a couple of days. This is a species that does not breed east of Colorado or New Mexico. So, and again, there was a couple of these sighted in the state. So that's why it's exciting to get out, because you never know what the next bird will be.
Never know. Caller wanted to mention that hummingbirds do that swinging behavior all the time. We were talking about that swinging like on a tree limb, like a swing, and hummingbirds will do that.
That's courtship flight, yes.
Yeah, courtship. And then Judith just posted a link on the Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, to a UW Oshkosh live video cam of a falcon nest.
Yes, that's really exciting. That's a new development this year. Some people in the UW Oshkosh area noticed peregrine hanging around, and Greg Septon, who does a lot of the peregrine work here in eastern Wisconsin, got a box up on the building there. And two young hatched this past week. There's a third egg that's probably not going to hatch, and you can watch those. And there's a number of cams around. The We Energies facilities all have nest cams on theirs. It's not live video, but it's pictures that are updated every minute.
Lot of fun.
Yeah, and I actually got to help band some young peregrines at the Port Washington Generating Station this week. So they're growing like a wildfire.
Well, with that, we have to close. Guys, thank you so much for taking some time today to be with us.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
And people can follow up with their photos and email, and we'll help them out afterwards.
All right. Thanks so much. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, our guests. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page to see the pictures and to post your own. Stay with us.